Hello and welcome back to Season 3 of Listening to the Dead. This is Episode 2, Offender Profiling and the Murder of Yvonne Killian.
Hello everyone, we're back at Shay Linda to record episode 2 on offender profiling and its role in the investigations of the murders of Yvonne Killian and Rachel Nickell. The term profiling means different things to different people, but I have here in front of me a definition that reads, method of suspect identification which seeks to identify a person's mental, emotional and personality characteristics based on things done or left at a crime scene. It's an investigative tool that is said to have been first tried out in Britain during the hunt for Jack the Ripper in 1880. Profiling, since then, has had rather a checkered history, with both police and the media at times lauding it as the future and then doubting its usefulness. Today, profiling is known as behavioural investigative advice. And to share the stage with Linda and Kaz today, we have one of the few experts in the field, Pippa Gregory, Senior Behavioural Investigative Advisor at the National Crime Agency. Welcome, Pippa. So how am I doing so far on a potted history of profiling?
That's not bad. It's not bad.
Well, the case we're looking at today to peer into the emergence of profiling are those of Yvonne Killian and Rachel Nickell, both of which involved profiling to varying degrees. We'll start with the case of Yvonne Killian. To give a bit of background here, in 1999, the body of Yvonne Killian was found strangled in her flat in South London. She'd been sexually abused, and following her death, the murderer had tried to set her alight using vodka. She'd been found by her boyfriend, who was then prime suspect in the investigation. During the investigation, Detective Chief Inspector Chris Horn decided to call in Dr. Richard Babcock, a leading forensic psychiatrist, to give an alternative view on some of the unusual aspects of the case. Dr. Babcock was followed by a film crew making a programme called The Real Cracker, referencing the successful TV series of the time starring Robbie Coltrane as an offender profiler. So, that's where we pick up the case, except to add that one young, ambitious junior detective happened to be cutting his teeth on that case, and he's sitting next to me here. It's Kaz Sutherland. Hey Kaz, over to you. What are your memories of hearing about the case and the early stages of the investigation?
The early stages was really hearing the next morning, being all told to come in that a murder had happened overnight down in Erith, in a little block of terraced houses. The early stages were really sort of house-to-house inquiries, trying to find out a bit more about her. But also the boyfriend was arrested at the start on the basis that he had phoned the ambulance service, and then instead of phoning the police, he'd phoned his boss at work, and they thought that that was rather strange, so they arrested him. I mean, obviously, he was in a total state of shock, having gone in through the rear window that was broken and finding her. I mean, personally, I think that if you haven't got enough evidence, don't arrest him, because treat them as a witness, because that's your better chance of getting evidence. But I think at the same time, because he was the sort of prime suspect, everything sort of concentrated on him, and I actually think things at the scene that could have been done better weren't, because right, well, it's a boyfriend, that's it, case solved. And then of course it became apparent that it wasn't him, and then it of course the DNA, there was a DNA that was found, semen found on her breast and her mouth, I think it was, and it didn't match to the boyfriend, so clearly we had to find who this DNA belonged to.
So at what stage did Richard Babcock get called in, and do you remember your feeling and the team's feelings when that happened?
I think it was about 2 weeks in. I think Chris Horn went to see him. He never actually came to the office. Then he came, we went down to the scene and he examined the scene, but that was a good three weeks or so afterwards. Then he did his report. That was where the kind of, I don't know if friction would be the right word, but that was where a lot of us couldn't see, well, what is your basis for making those conclusions? A lot of us thought that this is a burglary that had gone wrong. And then he came to the office to discuss it. But if I'm honest, there wasn't a lot of discussion.
How so?
I think he felt a little bit I don't, maybe threatened by us, but at the same time, I think we felt a little bit that we were being talked down to, but we just wanted to put our experiences and sort of have a constructive argument, but it didn't really happen, if I'm honest. I had my opinion about what had happened in the body. He said the body had been symbolically placed in the settee. I offered an alternative, which I strongly believed in, but what it should have been is that we discuss the different possibilities. Everybody discusses them, and then you rule out, well, this can't have happened because we now know this, or that must have happened because we now know this, and that didn't really occur, unfortunately.
Well, let's get the side of the profiler. So I said this began with Jack the Ripper profiling, but actually, obviously, modern profiling started a lot later. But so we'd sort of say this was the early days of modern profiling, maybe, Pippa. Would that be fair?
So I think the case you're talking about is 1998.
I think it was 1998, yeah.
So that's actually probably about 13 years or so, perhaps even more than that, since profiling started in the very first off in the UK. So there had been sort of new people had been brought in. There was and there was some structure at that time to profiling as well. But as you say, it still was very much sort of outside people coming in to investigations. So sort of psychologists coming in and, if you like, almost sort of playing at being investigators. So there wasn't really that integration, I don't think, at that stage of profiling or psychology within an investigation. It was still very much, as Kath sort of described, this outside person coming in, talking at an investigation about what they thought, and then leaving again with sort of their advice left on the table.
Yeah, and I suppose by its nature then that did lead to more conflict than, say, you'd see today, because you're parachuting somebody in and they're not part of the investigation. They're sort of coming in with advice and a report that maybe doesn't agree with what the investigative team is looking at.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, that still happens these days. We're not a part of the investigation itself. We're still very much brought in to give advice. But the difference is, I think, that Dr. Richard Badcock was a very eminent forensic psychiatrist, very brilliant in his field, but he didn't know investigations, as it's not surprising. Whereas nowadays we are brought up as sort of understanding investigations and psychology, and it's the blend of the two. So when we go in, we understand what the detectives are going through. And obviously Richard and the other profilers at that time had less experience of that. I was profiling at the time. So, you know, it wasn't all like that, but that was certainly one side of profiling, the clinical side.
So at what point did Badcock come in? Had the victim's body been removed? Did he actually see her in situ? Or was he actually given photographs of how they had seen this crime scene? Because I'm just seeing the difference between being able to step away and look at evidence to actually being confronted by it, and what you can gain from that moment of seeing a victim. Because they always say, you know, 24 hours is the most important time. And, I mean, did you, Cass, view her in situ or not?
No, I didn't go. I didn't actually go to the scene other than after the body had been moved. It's generally uniform that are first on the scene because they get called to those things.
So how long was it before Badcock came in?
It's got to be at least, well, as I said, I think 2 weeks when Chris Horn went to speak to him, and then coming to the scene, I think maybe three, 4 weeks. Because I think one of the things that happened early on is that things were said without any sort of substantive evidence to back them up, and were sort of theories, and some of that was given to Badcock, which I kind of felt that influenced his thoughts as well. I mean, a lot of this is, I must say, is hindsight and looking back at things and that, and from what I've sort of learned since. And that kind of like sometimes goes down a chain and can send things off in the wrong direction. You know a lot more than I about how in investigations people can be easily led because they've tried to find things that fit what their beliefs are. But I kind of wondered, looking back at it, if some of it was because Badcock was trying to find things that fitted the type of people that he dealt with in the institutions that he worked in.
Well, I think by our very human nature, we try and find patterns that we recognise. So as you said, it's probably likely that Richard would have gone in, and he understands very deviant, violent individuals, so he will sort of be looking at it from that lens. So he will see information that will sort of, you know, purport to that kind of belief he's got. Similarly, you as the detective with years and years of experience of burglaries will be looking at it in terms of, well, what can I see from a burglar perspective here? That is to say, it is human nature. And one of the things that, again, we know about these days very much is around the whole decision-making process and the impact of heuristics and bias within that. So heuristics are sort of the shortcuts of decision-making that we make. So as you said, Richard will be using his expertise to shortcut decision-making processes. It doesn't mean that he's going to be wrong in that. It's just an easier way of doing it. But similarly, as you as a detective would be doing the same thing. But what we know now is actually we just recognise where we might have those biases and heuristics in place. And we've got processes in place to make sure that we can be that one step back, that little bit more objective, to try and stop that happening, as you said. Because I think there is actually, I've seen sort of footage of Richard talking, and there's a conversation about the phone, and you can almost see him saying, oh yes, well that obviously then makes sense because he already thinks that the individual knows Yvonne. He then says, well obviously he would have to have broken back in to get the phone because obviously his details would be on the phone. So, you know, again, that's sort of the confirmation bias evidence in play.
What I wanted to ask you was, when you're reading all the facts about this very tragic case, a lot of focus is on the perpetrator. How did he get in? Did he come back? Did he break the window to get in to try and create or lose evidence? Whereas, because you're a female, how much more do you as a woman feel that you can add to scene? And the reason I'm asking this is that the clothing in the victim's bedroom, some had been put away, some had been folded and put out. But a very important part of this were the tights that were used to strangle her. Mm. And, you know, there were tights found in her apartment. And eventually it came to the conclusion that they weren't hers. Mm-hmm. He brought them with him. And so do you ever think that as a woman, you would look at a different perspective?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, you bring your own knowledge with you to any of this. So I've had very interesting conversations with my two male colleagues. I'm the only female at the moment in our discipline, and I have two male colleagues. And we've had all sorts of interesting conversations around how women wear tights, for example. Do you wear sort of one pair of underpants underneath the tights, then another pair on top? And all these kinds of conversations won't even go through their head. So I will bring that sort of that understanding and that, I guess, that sort of perspective when we're looking at cases, absolutely. But I'm also then very aware that there's a danger that I will overinterpret things because as a female, I might have done something that the victim hasn't. So again, there's always those checks and balances in place. But no, I will look at things differently. But also, they will probably be able to sort of to appreciate some of the aspects of what the offender is doing more because they can see things from a masculine perspective. So actually, that's why it's sort of the beauty of the two different approaches coming together. But yes, you can't help but use your own experience. And obviously, I am a female, so that's the experience that I've got.
Thank you.
When Carl Sturt was arrested.
So I should just jump in because the listener won't have a clue how the case progressed. So I'm just going to say, you could talk us through this, but as I understand it, Richard Babcock came in the profile and he did suggest that it was a sexually motivated crime and the boyfriend was probably not the prime suspect then. And those factors were borne out, in the investigation. And you came across quite quickly a new prime suspect in the form of Carl Sturck, a man previously convicted of stalking women and who, it turned out, had recently been dumped by a girlfriend who bore somewhat of a resemblance to the murdered girl, Yvonne Killian. Is that right?
Yes. But to an extent, I mean, some of the photographs you looked at of her, she didn't look at all like Yvonne, and a couple... She did. I mean, I actually never physically met her. I wasn't quite sure if it was just something to sort of try, you know, that was made to try and sort of fit. But certainly the evidence that she was able to give about his, the way that he would want her to, he'd like to have violent sex, the way that she saw him one night walk following a woman down this alleyway just by Erith Town, which I think was the same alleyway where he had attacked two women 7 years before. And how she got out of the car and shouted at him. And then she found some of her tights in his pocket and asked, and he said, "Oh, that's because I like to be close to you." But picking up on what Pippa said earlier, when he was arrested and interviewed, he kind of like knew what he was, had an answer for everything that day to distance himself and totally denied murder. But when some of us suggested that, why don't we put a female officer in to interview him? The SIO and others said, no, we can't do that. Well, why not? Well, because that could, if we went to court, if he made an admission, that could be seen as oppressive behaviour to try and get him to make a confession. Therefore, we shouldn't do it. But to me, I thought, well, why not? Because it would have been interesting to see how he, would he have reacted differently? Would he maybe have lost his temper or something that would have given, that could have been used as evidence against him? But
certainly in the Real Cracker, the documentary that followed Richard Babcock in this, he was then in the next door room to the interview, either reading transcripts, I can't remember, or listening in. Would that be normal for a profiler to be that involved?
Back then that did happen a fair amount. And we would argue nowadays that there's a real danger inherent in doing that, because one, you've got your own idea of what's happened at the crime scene. You then identified a suspect who you think has behaved in the way that you've already identified in your head. And then you're then again suggesting how to do the interview. So it's not necessarily a very good idea to have the person right from the beginning of profiling all the way through. And actually, again, these days, we don't get involved. From a profiler perspective, I have got nothing to say about interviewing. I don't have any expertise in relation to how you would talk to a suspect at all. There's obviously very strict rules around how you can do that. So whilst our initial thoughts are often given to the interview advisor in terms of preparing for an interview, then we don't get involved in the interview process at all. You do still get clinical or forensic psychologists advising interview strategy. But that kind of downstream monitoring, which is what you're sort of describing around Dr. Badcock sitting in another room and watching what's happening and then sort of feeding into the process, that very unusual these days.
I wonder, though, again, it's hindsight, but looking at it, that the attacks on 7 years earlier wore a balaclava. We know the night that he broke in, he was wearing woolen gloves. We know that there were other attacks, early morning robberies at and around the time before Yvonne's murder in Erith, again near that place. He was a night shift worker. He finished at 7:30. These attacks were robberies where there were sexual assaults. He would come up behind wearing a balaclava, sexually assault them quickly, and then steal property and run off. They all stopped after he was arrested. But what I wondered was, if he broke into that house and it was a burglary, and I wonder if she had to die because she had seen him. She could identify him because in his other crimes, he always, you know, when he did his things, he wore a balaclava. And also, like with the stealing from the ladies who he sexually assaulted and stole their purse or whatever, it was almost, I wonder, like, I'm not a pervert, I'm a thief. And again, like in Yvonne's case, he stole the PlayStation. I mean, they're easily saleable, but I wondered, after having murdered her, if he then takes that, is he trying to say to himself, I'm not a pervert, I'm a thief?
I think it's possible that we always tend to try and find sort of one motive behind these things. So it's either a burglary gone wrong or it's a sexual murder. And I think that the reality is there's often a whole sort of combination of factors going on. I don't know the details of the case, and I sort of obviously can't stand here as a profiler and say, well, what happens is, but I wonder if actually there is the two elements. And, you know, you see an awful lot of sexual murderers now who are voyeurs. I don't know if there's any suggestion that he was a voyeur. I wouldn't be surprised at all that actually in his burglary kind of activity, he is listening at the windows and watching women in their houses. So sort of then to break into the house, to enter into the house and commit an assault, is not a big stretch from that. So we've still got the sexual and then the violence comes out in relation to, as you were saying, Linda, in relation to what's been going on in his background. Mm. But it all comes together in one thing. So I think it probably is a burglary. I think it probably is a sexual murderer. But I think that they're just, it's all part of the same process.
Yeah. I think also at this point, he had escalated into the kill because the curtain was partly open and the ear print is on the window. So the lights had to have been on. He had to have known she was in there. He didn't just break in to do a burglary and then get out. He knew she was in there. He had gloves on. And, you know, that he got in, maybe the coincidence was the click of the door, the intercom door was open, which is how he got in the first place. But I think he had reached that level in his sexual perversion to kill or to rape. But did they ever find out if he also had taken the vodka, or was the vodka bottle belonged to the couple?
The vodka belonged to that. There was a fingerprint on it, which came back to a friend of theirs who had genuinely bought it for them for Christmas. Yeah. He used it as an accelerant.
But he also used it sexually, didn't he?
I think that was believed a possibility, but I don't think they found any traces on the actual bottle. But he
So the ear print on the window is what fascinates. See, he must have been peering in that window as a stalker.
Well, she had gone to bed, and the lights. The boyfriend said that she had gone to bed because she hadn't been feeling well, and she was going to go to work later. But the lights had been out, so that would have been one of the only out of those ones along there. Two of the flats had alarms, and people were in one of them next to theirs. So the one that, if she had turned all the lights out, that wouldn't have any lights on, would have been that one.
Let's look at where the investigation started to diverge from Dr. Babcock's profile. Okay, so we know that at the beginning, you know, he said it was unlikely to be the boyfriend. That proved to be correct. At what stage did you sort of start to have these disagreements about? And it was generally about the position of the body. I seem to remember you saying
he believed that the body had been sort of deliberately and symbolically placed. I felt that there was an alternative, that actually the position she ended up in was just a natural thing from her, him forcing her to do oral sex on the edge. And she would have, if she was on the edge of the settee and her legs were apart, if he then strangled her shortly after this happened, then let go, then that would just account for the position that she was actually in.
His suggestion was that the position of the body, the taking of a prized possession, was that right, in the PlayStation? And these various things suggested that there was more consideration about the killing than just...
To an extent, but I think that he thought, along with the pathologist, that she'd been sexually assaulted in the bedroom because of the feces on the bed. And in the corner of the room was a jar of coins that had been knocked over. And the window, the curtain that was open. But again, this was a bit hindsight in getting interested in looking afterwards, was that if she was in bed asleep and you heard this smash in the living room, what we all do if we hear a noise at night and we're in bed, the first thing we do is we jump out and look out the window. Even if the sound comes from the front of the house or the back, we will naturally look out the window. And that's what, with the curtain being open and so large, you had the grass stain in the middle, so I wondered if he's heard her. He didn't know she was. He's heard her. He's gone straight into the bedroom. One step is the feces on the edge of the bed, which turned out to be his. And the second step was the grass stain. Then grabbing her by the window, which is where the coins, the struggle could have happened. But then taking her into the living room and raping her there and murder her was because the broken window behind him is his entry. So that's his exit. Mm. He can't get out anywhere else, really. He can't go out the front if somebody comes to the front. And the keys were in the door. But again, that's not uncommon for burglars who, if they can find a spare key, or they'll put the L lock on if they force the front door, they'll put the L lock back on so it gives them opportunity if somebody comes to the door to get out the back.
Yeah. So, I mean, okay, so we know that the investigation team, you know, your ideas diverged. When you look back now on this case, do you think that there was some useful information that Dr. Babcock bought, maybe a different viewpoint? I mean, what was your view of profiling at the time and after having worked on this case?
If I'm honest, at the time, I didn't really know a lot about it. And I kind of got in it after that case and other cases. But, I mean, it was a bit of the roughy-toughy old detectives who don't like people coming in and telling them how to do their job. But at the same time, I think, looking at it now, you have to look at things in different ways and listen to other people's opinions. And then you sit down and you work out, right, this seems to be the best theory that on the evidence we know. Then as more evidence comes in, you go over that again and again and again and again to sort of narrow down, you know, when you're in a strange murder kind of scenario. But I don't know if, had you ever heard of Anne Davis, who was a scientist?
Yes, I know Anne.
Anne Davis at that time, who was a scientist who worked at the lab, had got into, they were sort of looking at profiling in a way of to do the rapes and that and the things they say and do. But one of her things that, looking back, if we'd have used that right away, was looking at the scene, arson, burglary, and assault. Carl Sturck used to break into business premises during the night, go in, he used to use a baseball bat, smash the window, steal petty cash. He then, on one occasion, set light to the place, and of course he had attacked women. If you look for somebody in the local area with those three convictions, Sturck would have come up high on that list and would have been swabbed earlier. He was swabbed only because an old sweat PC who was about to retire just happened to say, I dealt with this chap 7 years ago who attacked two women, and that's why he was swabbed. He was, I think, the second person actually swabbed.
So actually, I mean, like, it's a really good case for a profiler, Pippa, because you've got somebody who's, you know, modus operandi doesn't really change. I mean, he changes a bit, but it's all there, everything he's done before. So it's not a bad example of where profiling would have been useful. It just didn't quite work out in this case.
Absolutely. As I said, I can't comment on Richard's profile because I wasn't there. But it's interesting. I think your definition that you showed or you used right at the beginning about profiling was all about personality and emotion and sort of the mental state. Whereas what Kaz has just talked about now is exactly, let's look at their characteristics that the police can do something with. So it's looking at burglary and assault and arson. So, and this is the danger that we've sometimes got, or how profiling used to be done. It was all about sort of the personality and the characteristics. And that can sound really interesting, but it doesn't get the investigation. You know, when you talk to the wife, suddenly you can start to make sense of the personality and the characteristics that are being talked about. But as an investigative strategy, which is what profiling is all about these days, there just wasn't any back in that kind of approach to profiling. And that was the real issue with it.
Also, Badcock had asked to interview the perpetrator, but not during the trial and after, but in prison.
Oh,
but he never got the opportunity. He was refused permission. No.
We got him out of prison while he was on remand to interview him about all the robberies that had happened. But he denied them all. But the strange thing was they all stopped those early morning ones after he'd been arrested.
Yeah.
You know, in this case, a profiler was called in because the case had various sort of interesting features that might have worked. When is a profiler normally called in? And has that changed from this period to when you are called in now?
So Kaz saying that Richard's brought in about week two, something like that. That's in terms of the timing, that's absolutely right. So for example, those... Linda was talking about sort of the initial 24 hours when all the information comes together. There is no role for a profiler at that stage of investigation because, quite frankly, we're going to get in the way. We're going to ask questions that nobody can answer because, you know, a really important part of the profiling stage is to understand that this is an interaction between two people, sometimes three people, sometimes four, but often two people. So we have to understand as much as we can about the victim as well as the offender. In those early stages, we're never going to know that. There could also be forensic evidence that comes back and finds the individual straight away. So we don't need to get involved in the early stages. So we will tend to get involved after maybe 5 days, 10 days, 2 weeks. It could be later. In terms of what kind of cases we get involved in, it is totally up to the investigation whether they call us. And essentially, we are a service that's now provided by the National Crime Agency. It's a free service to any UK police force. And they can simply phone up a central, essentially like a helpline, and they can say, I have got this murder that's happened. These are the circumstances. I need some help. And they might not know that they want a profiler. They might not know exactly what they want. But then it's, I work in a broader team of specialists. So we have behavioral investigative advisors within that, but we also have interview advisor, we have family liaison advisor, et cetera, who are essentially at the top of their discipline within investigations. And we can be called in then to go and see the investigation and discuss the case with them. But it could be all sorts of different types of offences, but it's in the major crime field. So essentially that's an interpersonal, serious sexual or violent offence. So generally it's murder or rape. It might be a sort of a suspicious death. Sometimes we do arsons if there's like a possibility of endangering life. Other cases here and there, but the bulk of what we do is rapes and murders, and it could be essentially where they don't know who's done it.
We tend to think of like you coming in when there's a serial killer, a serial rapist. Mm-hmm. But is that really it, or can it be just a single case?
Single case, absolutely. And to be honest, the reality is, touch wood, still in the UK, those kinds of offences are few and far between. You know, it can be one rape, it can be one murder. And yes, there will still be a wealth of behavioural information that we can take with that and to help the investigation.
If you take on serial killers, known, the most infamous one, Ted Bundy, and the amount of interviews with profilers and everyone that has tried to dissect the compulsive urge this man had to kill. But eventually, bit by bit, when you saw this man's intelligence, when he was defending himself in court, the outcome eventually was he was pure evil. For Yvonne to die in the way she did by this inept, unfocused creep of a man, is just, in the end, you say he was evil. I found just reading for, you know, research for today, the sadness of the repercussions and what happened to that young, hardworking woman is just so awful. So you say there is evil. Do you believe that the evil is sometimes the root of the
kill? It's difficult for me to answer that because my job isn't to understand whether it's somebody who's evil that's doing it, etc. My job is to help the investigation find the person. The rationale behind why they're doing what they're doing isn't actually something for a behavioural advisor to do. Having said that, I think if you look at the backgrounds of pretty much all the people that we've been involved in, the cases of the people that are responsible, in the vast majority of the cases, something has happened to them, they have got some sort of background, whatever, that has led them to become what they've become. I don't know many cases that I've been involved in where somebody has simply been born that way. Now, I'm sure that must happen, but the vast majority of cases that I've seen, there has been something, some sort of understandable, if you sort of trace back through their early childhood, etc., there is something that's often happened which you think, okay, well, maybe that's the explanation for why they've gone down the route that they've done. It doesn't, as you say, it doesn't justify it at all, but I think there's sometimes a more tangible piece of, you know, whether that's a lack of attachment or whatever as a child, but there's generally something in their background.
In sort of connection to like the Bundy thing, from what I know of as well, one of the problems was that it was because it was in different states and different force areas, there was no communication, there was no sort of database of crimes to find that could this be the same person. But I think now at the National Crime Agency that there are many different types of databases which help you if somebody sort of phoned you up, oh, we've got this case, you may even know of a similar one you've dealt with, but the database must be invaluable for information.
Absolutely. We have the serious crime analysis section, sort of it's known as SCAS. They collect every stranger rape and sexual homicide in the UK. They have done for a number of years. Their database has got sort of over 20,000 cases on it. So it's my job as a behavioural investigative advisor to give an opinion about whether two offences have been committed by the same offender. But we absolutely rely on the statistics from this massive database to be able to say, okay, well, these offences share these behaviours. And they are statistically very unusual for two offences to share that. Therefore, it helps the decision-making process for the investigator. Because it's not me up to me to link the cases, but it is the investigator's decision. So I need to provide them with the information to do that. Actually, the remit of the serious crime analysis section is to identify similar offences throughout the UK. So it's absolutely saying, so if we had a Ted Bundy, heaven forbid, in the UK now, we would hope that we'd actually have people in SCAS and other areas that would actually be able to spot those similarities of behaviour, which you simply couldn't do back then.
So another tragic case from this period is that of Rachel Nicole, stabbed while she was walking across Wimbledon Common with her two-year-old son. That was in July 1992, and the detectives turned then to profiler Paul Britton. Now, whether he was an integral part of the investigation that followed, it's kind of debatable, but what is not is that the investigation was littered with errors and pursued the wrong man for over a year, during which time the real culprit committed further atrocities.
I think also that entire Rachel Nicole case really did put a lot of profiling into a bad area.
Oh, it was awful. And to be honest, it didn't recover for 10 years after that, I would think. I mean, a huge amount of changes had to be put. And in fact, one of the reasons why we're now called behavioural investigative advice is, one, because it actually describes what we do better, because we don't just come up with a profile. Yeah. We actually do sort of a whole range of services around what we do. But also, some of the reason was the fact that the whole terminology offender profiling was just really negatively perceived within the public, but also mainly within policing. Yeah. So it was important that actually we needed to show that that's not what we did anymore. That, you know, that's not how we operate. That's not what it worked.
Why was that off the back of the Rachel Nicole case, do you think?
Because essentially, Colin Stagg being taken to court, being acquitted, it was a very public display of how profiling worked really badly. Not only sort of was sort of Paul Britton, and I don't know the reality, I wasn't in that investigation, but Paul Britton essentially provided a profile that was then sort of found to match Colin Stagg. And then there was a whole honey trap
was advised by profiling how to behave, what to ask.
Exactly. And that's what Paul Britton did. So it was really destructive. I think, you know, playing devil's advocate, the investigation should have been very aware that that was totally inappropriate.
But
Paul Britton, I think, was pretty much the fall guy for that. But he was responsible for advising as to how do you trap Colin into saying that he was involved. So it was awful. I mean, it was everything that profiling shouldn't be about. And unfortunately, it was the biggest sort of
blow up
explanation, illustration of what profiling was when it was
the detectives themselves, I think. I think when they found this guy who walked his dog on the common, who was, you know, to them a bit odd, they pushed him forward. And I think they just, you kind of wonder, well, did it influence the profile as much as the profile? It's this,
absolutely,
you know, telling each other what you want to hear and off you go totally down the wrong road. And that's where I think, like I said, it's if all sit around and if they challenged their own theories, well, hang on a minute, what actual evidence have we got?
One of the main things that we teach when we train, when we give an input to the SIA training courses, one of the first things we say to them is it's your role to challenge the behavioural advice you're given. You have to be able to say, so what? Why are you telling me that? I don't understand where that's come from. What does that mean to me? And that's absolutely an important one. If you're going to bring a profiler or a BIA into your investigation, you have to be willing to challenge what you're being given. Otherwise, you can't possibly expect to make decisions on the basis of it if you don't understand why it's been said.
Do you find that sometimes some SIs are frightened to challenge because they feel they don't understand enough about your...
It's very much. But to be honest, you know, a lot of what we do now is we understand psychology, we understand offending behaviour, but we also understand decision-making. So we sort of, I guess if you like, part of our role is actually that sort of negotiation with an SIO. That's part of what we have to do. And part of that will be making sure that we don't come across as somebody who comes in and tells them how to run their investigation. That's absolutely what we're there to do.
I have an amazing story about Colin Stagg, who we all know was found innocent. And I had a Great Dane. A Great Dane who was very quiet, very calm dog. And there's a gate to Richmond Park. And I was going to go through the gate and my Great Dane went berserk. He never growled. He was on his hind legs, barking, going crazy. And eventually when I went open the gate, Colin Stagg was standing there with two Labradors. Now, was it the dogs? What was it? Because I didn't know he was there. But I saw, and I went, oh, concert. And this, I mean, it's just, was it a coincidence? Was the Great Dane barking against the dogs? I don't know.
Innocent man.
Yeah.
Have you ever been asked to go to a parole board?
No. Nope. As my role, I have never given evidence in court. It wouldn't be appropriate in terms of the kind of evidence we give, the kind of report we produce. It's purely an intelligence product. I've never interviewed an offender. I have never been to a parole board.
But surely, if you were given the facts of a prisoner and his crime, you would be able to say he isn't finished. You release him, he's going to kill again.
Do you not have that in your... No, that's not my response. You'd have a forensic clinical psychologist or somebody like Richard Bagg, whatever, they would be able to give an opinion on that because they have the clinical expertise. So they have basically been trained and qualified in sort of all the personality disorders, mental illnesses, all that kind of stuff. My training is what we call an investigative psychologist. So it's much more about the application of psychology and understanding an unknown offender's behaviour at a crime scene. When it comes to a particular individual, then I don't get involved in that. So as soon as the suspect is identified, I step back and another qualified psychologist will come in from a slightly different sphere to be able to assess the individual.
So how many times are you called out in a year at the moment?
There's three of us doing what we do, and it will depend time to time, but generally probably about 100 cases between the three of us that will be called in. Some of those will simply be a phone call with the investigation sometimes, and we have a briefing on the case and we say, actually, you know, I can't offer anything for my discipline. This is, you know, this isn't for me. It would be inappropriate. And that can then lead up to other cases where we will be involved for a period of months, sort of dipping in and out as the progress of the investigation moves on.
I think you mentioned before a case where you were called in to look at DNA or a DNA profile. Is that right?
So we have recently, in the last maybe 10 years, familial DNA has come on quite a lot in investigations now, and it's been used more often. When you're looking at familial DNA, it's a little bit different because you're looking to identify the relatives of the offender, not the actual offender themselves. And the lists that are produced by the National DNA Database in that can lead to hundreds, actually thousands of potential relatives. So my two colleagues actually developed a methodology for being able to prioritise that. At the moment, when it's provided to an investigation, it's prioritised in relation to genetic similarity. What we have been able to do is basically apply additional methodology that shows in relation to the age of the potential relative and also where they live, sort of like in terms of where they have geographic connections. We can actually assist that and sort of reprioritise that list. Done to good effect recently in, I'm sure you've probably all seen the offences of David Fuller, who was recently convicted of two, again, horrific murders in Kent some many years ago. And also obviously the subsequent investigation into what he's been doing in the hospital since then. But that was, David Fuller was initially identified through a familial DNA search. And actually my colleague was working to support them on that case and brought him up from lower down, or his relative from lower down that list is sort of to much higher up, which was certainly influential in terms of identifying him as a suspect. Mm.
Do you go and talk about your work much, apart from to people like us? We spoke at the beginning about Cracker and Robbie Coltrane's portrayal of a profiler. It's still not that well known. And do you go out and talk about it and publicise?
You're right, it's not very well known at all. And unfortunately, it's a fascinating area. I mean, I can say that I do it and I'm passionate about the job. But it's interesting and fascinating for so many people. And because of that, there continues to be quite a lot of sort of fictional portrayal of it. Unfortunately, not very well researched, unlike a lot of Linda's work. So we do get to see this this idea of what profiling is, like the real the cracker and the at the time, which is so far removed from the truth. The difficulty is that there are only three of us. We can't go and sort of do a lot of talks about what we do because, quite frankly, we're quite busy a lot of the time. But we do train senior investigating officers about the job that we do. Unfortunately, police officers, like members of the public, watch fictional portrayals, and sometimes their understanding of what we can do is wrong. Occasionally, myself and my colleagues will talk on maybe sort of psychology master's courses, for example, in forensic psychology. And again, more of that is, one, because it's really important for us to have relationship with the academic world. And obviously, we can talk about what we do in terms of the research side of things. But also because, unfortunately, there are more and more sort of degree courses being marketed on the idea of, well, you can do this and become a profiler. And the reality is so far from that. So it's quite important that we sometimes just go out and redress actually what it's made to look.
Yeah. Are there only three of you because that's how many we need in the country, or because that's how many are qualified?
It's if you like, it's sort of an evolution of how profiling has developed. So very early days, there was a couple of mavericks, if you like, sort of trying this out in the area. There then became a lot more people come aboard, and lots of psychologists decided they'd try it. Then the Rachel Nickell case happened, and I'm sure we might talk about that. And then sort of the governing body of policing, the Association of Chief Police Officers, decided they needed to have an accreditation system for profilers. That ended up with, at one point, I think about 20 people in the country were accredited as being recognised to give profiling advice. But then actually sort of over the last century, since 2001, there was a strategic review, and it was recognised that actually there are still some sort of inherent dangers with the number of people that are out doing that have different ways of profiling. And when you actually started to look at sort of the management information, if you like, sort of the nuts and bolts of how many cases are actually using a profiler, how are they being used, is it effective, there was this recognition that actually you didn't need this whole load of people doing it. You could actually do it in a more centrally controlled way. It ended up with another review, in 2010, which ended up with being five individuals being employed centrally delivering the service. We had been employed centrally before, but then sort of it was the others were recognised as experts. But in terms of coming through to the central point and having a profiler assigned, if you like, a case or invited to involve in a case, they all came centrally. There were five of us, policing cuts, etc., all happened, and it ended up with being three of us at the moment.
I think at one point when there was literally 20 doing it, I think if you phoned up and you wanted a profiler, they would give you three or four names and you would choose
exactly
one of those names because they didn't want it to be seen, mm-hmm. you know, so that I think you make the choice. It's not up to us to decide on the individual. You choose from these names of people who are accredited.
So you don't see tension now between, there's a lovely scene in this documentary, The Real Cracker, where Dr. Babcock has come to see the detectives, and then the young Kaz gives a bit of heat back to try and, because you're having an exchange and you don't agree. And it struck me that we don't often talk about this in this podcast, but how often is there tension between the police and the scientists coming in to help?
There is sometimes. I mean, actually on that, when I, having got more into the science, I mean, detectives are, I don't know so much now, but it might, were very much, he did it, I know he did it, and I'm going to find everything to prove he did it. And they would look for everything to prove what they believed. But then when you say to them, well, hang on a minute, I hear what you say, but can you tell me what the evidence is to support that? And you'd be, you know, I'd be called, oh, you're just being negative. I said, no, I'm being realistic. I don't doubt you're probably right, but we need to find the evidence. And I think sometimes they'd sit back and thinking, well, forensics have solved this. I'm sure you've seen, I've seen murder scenes where, we think they've used sellotape and everything, and we think, oh, we're going to find something, rubber gloves, DNA or a fingerprint inside the glove. Nothing, not a thing. So you don't always find what you're looking for. And conversely, sometimes if you look too deep, you miss what's on the surface.
Well, we're out of time. Thank you very much, Linda, Cass, Pippa. Thank you for joining us. That's 140 years of profiling in under an hour. We'll be back next week for episode 3, Handwriting and the Yorkshire Ripper. Until then, please be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you're listening now. And if you're so inclined, give us a nice rating too. And if you want to know more about the podcast, then check out lyndalepant.com, where you can find out episode details from all the series. And of course, you can find out more about Linda's latest novel, Vanished.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of Listening to the Dead. My new novel, Vanished, is out on March the 31st, 2022, in hardback, ebook, and audiobook.